that may legally come before.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this term would be Scott Glow versus Iowa Mutual Insurance Company. For the appellant, Scott Glow is Ms. Nancy Turbeck, an attorney from Watertown. For the appellee, Iowa Mutual Insurance Company, is Mr. A.C. Matthews, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Beck, you may proceed.
Excuse me, but I got the wrong file.
Just a minute.
I got the wrong file.
It's... Proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Greetings to the court, the counsel, clerks, and thank you for the opportunity to come this morning and talk with you about this case. This dispute is about the underinsured motorist coverage that Scott Glow has for claims resulting from the losses that he suffered when an underinsured motorist caused the deaths of his parents. The question is, can an insurer refuse to pay benefits to compensate its insured for uncompensated damages based on a policy provision that says it will only cover damages that arise from bodily injuries sustained by an insured? There's three reasons why the answer to that is no. Three reasons why the court should refuse to enforce the particular policy provision in this case that restricts coverage. First, it's contrary to the language of South Dakota statute. Second, it violates the legislative intent of our underinsured motorist law. And third, it is inconsistent with the approach chosen by our legislature, namely that underinsured motorist coverage should function as a substitute for liability insurance coverage. I will talk, of course, at great length about those three reasons. But first, I want to make sure that we are all clear about what claims we are talking about here and what provision is at stake. The only claims involved in this case are Scott Glow's own claims arising from the deaths of his parents. There are no claims involved here that arise from any damages that third parties have. This case does not involve any claims that Larry or Verna May Glow themselves had for personal injury or that any other third parties may have had. The claims here are solely the claims of Scott Glow as a wrongful death survivor, a statutory beneficiary, and the claims are for the damages that he sustained. There is no involvement here of any damages for which he's already been compensated. We are talking only about uncompensated damages that Scott Glow has as a result of his parents' deaths. Those are the claims that were submitted to the carrier in this case. The provision at issue, the basis on which the carrier denied coverage, is a restriction that it inserted into its insurance agreement. On the underinsured endorsement, I believe it's page 52 of the settled record, the endorsement rather typically starts out with an insuring agreement. And initially it tracks with South Dakota statute. It essentially says we will pay damages that an insured is legally entitled to recover from an underinsured motorist. What is that dispute? The key here is four words that it inserted to restrict coverage. The four words are sustained by an insured. In other words, if you look at that insuring agreement, it says it will pay damages legally, that an insured is legally entitled to recover, but only if those damages arise from actual bodily injury that the insured sustained.
Before you go on, let me back up to, to the nature of his claim.
Right.
I understand that he had settled the wrongful death and he was he the personal representative of the estate or was it one of the other children?
He happened to be the personal representative, and of course he's also an individual beneficiary under the statute.
And they settled the wrongful death claim?
Yes, sir.
So this claim is for something other than wrongful death?
No, they settled the wrongful death claim for the limits of the liability coverage.
Okay.
And it has been agreed, it's stipulated that that Mr. Glow was not fully compensated for his wrongful death benefits or wrongful death damages. So this is exactly the claim. It's just the amount of the claim that's still uncompensated after the liability proceeds were exhausted.
Thank you.
Now, the restriction that the insurer put on is an important one because insureds in South Dakota will often have claims that arise, for claims for damages that do not arise from their own bodily injury. Every claim for wrongful death falls in that category, as do many claims that parents would have, for example, for medical expenses they incur on behalf of a child.
Just backing up a minute then, who would you see as the insured, the decedents or Scott?
Oh, Scott is the only insured. The decedents are not insured. And in fact, if this were a claim, their claim for personal injury, which survived their death, and indeed their estate had that claim, we would have no business claiming coverage. They wouldn't have coverage under this policy. The insureds...
Let me ask you then,
sure.
If the people that are injured don't have coverage, then why should there be coverage given to somebody else?
Because, Your Honor, our statute doesn't focus on bodily injury. You see, when you say the people who are injured, I suspect you're thinking who are physically injured, namely the decedents.
The legislature was concerned, obviously concerned, about people who get injured in automobile accidents. And the people that were injured in the automobile accident here had no claim under this policy, correct?
The people that were physically injured have no claim.
Okay.
A person who was legally injured, Scott Glow, has two very substantial claims. And I'm glad that you brought up what the legislature said, because that's really where we should start talking about this, is exactly what's the language of the statute. And that's the first point that I want to make, that this restriction is contrary to the statutory language. Because if you look at the underinsured motorist statutes, you'll see that our legislature has chosen to use language that does not talk about an insured being injured or an insured sustaining bodily injury. Our statutes focus on whether an insured is legally entitled to damages. In other words, we have basically a tort-based underinsured motorist framework where for someone to have a claim, they have to be legally entitled under tort law to damages from either an uninsured or an underinsured motorist. And if they then have uncompensated damages, they can make an underinsured or uninsured motorist claim. We do not have a system typically found in no-fault states, we do not have a system where it is bodily injury of the insured that triggers coverage. If that were the case, that's all you'd ask about, and you wouldn't inquire whether there was any tort claim against the underinsured or uninsured driver. But our statute, the language of our statute explicitly says that the insurer agrees to pay its insured uncompensated damages as its insured may recover. In other words, the underinsured statute talks about damages and insured may recover. Its counterpart, the uninsured motorist statute, uses words damages the insured is legally entitled to recover. So the legislature chose to focus on legal entitlement to damages as a key to coverage.
Following up on that, then, how would, let's say that the insured himself were... suffered injury and death in an accident, and the underinsured would kick in. Can he recover for his own death? How does that work?
Of course, that's indeed that's the irony of the position that the insurer has taken here. Because unless the insurer adds gratuitous language that creates additional insureds, an insured can never recover for his own death. His estate can never recover. We know that under consistent wrongful death law. The insured or his estate never has a claim for his wrongful death. So when an insurer puts in a statement that says we'll pay damages, but only if you're the one that sustained it, it negates a claim for death. And that is what is clearly contrary to the statutory language, because our statutes repeatedly refer to death. 58.11.9.4, which is the part of the underinsured motorist statute that talks about what amounts are required, refers to death repeatedly. It talks about bodily injury or death. It just doesn't just say bodily injury, but twice it says bodily injury or death. 9.5, which is actually the section that requires the coverage, says that the insurer must pay, it agrees to pay damages an insured may recover on account of bodily injury or death. So three different times the legislature has said that damages for death are supposed to be covered under underinsured motorist coverage. And it's interesting that the legislature said damages on account of death. It didn't say damages on account of death of an insured. It didn't, and it, when it talks about limits, it talks about the limits being, I'm sure you're familiar with at least 100,000 mandatory coverage for the bodily injury or death of one person, as far as mandatory, the amount of mandatory UIM coverage. But what my point is, the legislature said, referred in that section to the bodily injury or death of one person, or the bodily injury or death of two or more persons. It didn't say death of an insured or death of two or more insureds. And it's probably most telling that it says in the in 9.5, the legislature said the insurance company agrees to pay its own insured for damages on account of death. It agrees to pay its own insured for damages on account of death. It doesn't say the insured's next of kin it'll pay. And it says for damages an insured may recover on account of death. It doesn't say for damages an insured's next of kin might recover. So the language of our statute, and we have to trust that the legislature, when it adopted the underinsured motorist statutes dealing with death, that it had in mind the wrongful death statutes adopted decades before, that tell us that it is the survivors that have the claim. And so when our underinsured motorist statute says, if you have a claim for death, it needs to be covered by underinsured motorist coverage, it, clearly the legislature is talking about claims that the survivor, not the decedent, had. If the legislature had intended to allow UIM carrier to avoid coverage for an insured's wrongful death claim, why did it say that damages on account of death are to be covered? If the legislature intended to allow the kind of restriction on coverage that has been inserted in this policy, why didn't the legislature say it will allow damages or provide coverage for damages on account of death of an insured? But it didn't. The legislature used the term insured elsewhere in the statute, but it did not use it to qualify the damages that are supposed to be covered by underinsured motorist coverage.
Before you get too far, tell us about the majority and minority rules around the country. You know,
okay.
It looks to me like the majority is contrary to your position, and it looks to me like a number of the states whose high courts have decided the issue, as you'd suggest, the legislature has immediately turned around and changed the statute to essentially overrule the interpretation that you're suggesting.
Well, you've asked a couple different questions. One is, what really is the rule out there? And second, what are the legislatures doing? May I start briefly with the second? That's exactly the point. If the legislature wants a different policy in place for our state, it certainly can amend it, but it's not the role of this court to amend the statute, and it certainly isn't the role of an insurer to amend the statute. So it is true that in some states, after the high court has ruled and said this language means the kind of coverage I'm talking about here, in some instances the legislatures have been persuaded to change the statute. And that may occur in this state, but it is not to be changed in this courtroom. That's the role for the legislature to play. Second, Your Honor, it is not true that most of the high courts have ruled in a way contrary to our position. There are only there are four high courts that have ruled. Florida is the only one that ruled contrary in the Valiant case. That Supreme Court has since disavowed its own decision, and incidentally, that decision doesn't necessarily tell us much, because in Florida, wrongful death claims are very different. Wrongful death claims belong to the estate. And in fact, in the intermediate courts, and they come down both ways, in the intermediate courts where, for example, Arizona and Mississippi, I know some states cited, where they rule that the decedent had to be covered, it makes sense in those states because in those states it was the decedent or his estate that had the claim. So really, all of the opinions essentially are consistent. They're saying what makes common sense. Whoever has the claim, the person or entity with the claim, has to have coverage. And in this case, that's Scott Glow. Now, it's ironic, talking about the high courts, I mentioned that Florida is contrary, but you see a red flag as soon as you call it up on Westlaw, and they have disavowed their own opinion. But the three other Supreme Courts that have handled this have all ruled that a restriction like the one Iowa Mutual put in place here is invalid. The Supreme Court of Iowa has invalidated it. It's ironic that Iowa Mutual could not do in Iowa to its own citizens what it's trying to do in South Dakota. The Supreme Court of Nebraska has ruled likewise, as has the Supreme Court of Ohio. To my knowledge, and there are no other high courts that have ruled, and the defendant hasn't cited any.
Now, the two Iowa cases you cite deal with household members, both spouses. One was killed, one was injured. And here, as I understand it, your client's parents were not household members. They lived in a separate home. Is that accurate?
True, but in all cases, the deceased was not an insured under the policy.
I understand, but I mean, at least there's a distinction in Iowa that in those two cases that they were household members. Is that a meaningful distinction? In this case, doesn't make a difference.
I don't think it's a meaningful distinction, but it's an important point, Your Honor, because it's frightening as to what it could indicate in South Dakota. Under the language that Iowa Mutual has, if your spouse is not covered under your policy, you don't have coverage for their wrongful death under underinsured motorist coverage. So I think those opinions are important because we probably tend to assume families always are insured, all members under a policy. That isn't the case. But in terms of a distinction, I don't believe it's important. I think it's also important to bear in mind that we're not just talking about claims for wrongful death of parents or spouses here. This same situation will come up when a parent has a minor child that sustains bodily injury, and the parent may have huge damages for medical expenses. Maybe we've got hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages that they could collect from the tortfeasor, but if the tortfeasor is underinsured, they have to look to their UIM coverage. With this restriction, since it wasn't the insured, the parent, that had the bodily injury, there'd be no coverage.
Well, wait a minute, though. Under this, the way I read this policy, the children in the household would be insured.
If in this particular policy, I believe the children in the household are. That isn't necessarily all the case. And as the court's well aware, children unfortunately no longer always live in the household with their parent. Given divided families and foster care situations or whatever, what have you, we can't assume that we can just trust that the insurers will define insured so broadly that it will catch these folks whose damage or whose injury causes damage to the insured.
Well, it's a family auto policy, and it covers most family auto policies, at least that I'm familiar with, cover family members, correct?
In the household.
I guess by definition, if it's a family policy covering people in the household, yes. The point is that the statute says you have to cover these losses that an insured has. And neither this company nor any other has the right to say, well, we're going to not cover it because we want to put up an artificial barrier. And it's contrary to the purpose of UIM law. I think it's important to bear in mind the whole purpose of UIM law is to compensate uncompensated damages. That's the whole purpose. Why, if an insured is damaged due to wrongful death, why would we want to leave those damages uncompensated? It makes no sense to say that the purpose, that we're going to respect the statutory purpose when someone has their own bodily injury, however slight, but not when they have a huge claim arising from the bodily injury of someone else. The third point that, I want to talk just real quickly about not just the language of the statute and not just the purpose of compensating and incidentally maximizing coverage, as this court has many times held, but the problem with this restriction is it's inconsistent with the approach the legislature chose. Our legislature chose an approach that said, we're going to make folks have liability insurance. If they don't, or if it's insufficient, we're going to then have first-party insurance fill in. Underinsured motorist coverage essentially is a proxy for liability coverage. An underinsured motorist stands in the shoes, an underinsured motorist insurer stands in the shoes of the tortfeasor or his liability carrier. Now, if you make a wrongful death claim against a liability policy, no one would ever suggest that you as the claimant had to sustain bodily injury. And yet this UIM coverage is supposed to substitute for that liability coverage. It's an artificial barrier that violates the setup the legislature created to have UIM coverage substitute for liability coverage. Just because the claimant himself is not physically damaged doesn't mean that they can't make a wrongful death claim against a liability policy, nor should that restriction be allowed at the whim of an insured to prevent underinsured motorist coverage for the corresponding claim. So since the provision is in violation of the language and otherwise the law, I urge you to not allow its enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews, you may proceed, sir.
Please the court, counsel. The facts in this case are rather simple. Scott Lowe, the appellant in this matter, and his siblings are the only children of his parents, Larry Lowe and Verna Lowe, whose parents were unfortunately killed in this accident on September 1st, 2001. Thereafter, Mr. Lowe, as personal representative of those two estates, settled the claims against insurance carriers and took full and complete releases. However, prior to September 1st, 2001, the date of that accident, the IM insurance company had issued this policy and it had this particular endorsement on it that more or less restricts recovery because of bodily injury sustained by an insured. And I want to make it clear that Mr. Lowe has brought this action here, which we're here today, in his individual capacity and not as the personal representative of any estate. I believe there's four primary issues in this matter. The first one is that the endorsement in question is not contrary and incompatible with our statutes. And second, the majority of the jurisdictions hold that this kind of action is not permissible. Third, that Mr. Glow is not the real party in interest and does not have an individual claim for damages for wrongful death. And the last issue is the effect of the releases. As I mentioned, this endorsement is not incompatible. This endorsement is based upon several statutes, and particularly SDCL 5811-9.1, which starts out, says, subject to the terms and conditions of such underinsured motorist coverage, the insurance company agrees to pay and so forth. Now that statute has been considered by this court in several cases. In 1972, this court in Cimarron considered that statute and stated that it is a legislative recognition of the right of the insurance company to place conditions on the coverage.
But the conditions have to comport with public policy, obviously.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear you.
The conditions have to comport with public policy.
Yes, but in that case, it was with reference to the extent of the coverage and excluded a motor vehicle. If they can exclude a motor vehicle, it certainly can put the restriction on the injuries must be sustained by the insured. And then in this court, later on in the Westfield, and this is a 2001 case, relayed on that statute and said that the policy was subject to certain conditions. In the Eighth Court of Appeals in Brandenburg, this court excluded residents. So with those exceptions, I believe that the statute is authority for the company to place this language in their endorsement. And those endorsements have been honored by other courts And I call the court's attention to Delancey versus State Farm Mutual, which is a federal case wherein our Supreme Court stated that the federal court stated that that the policy holder could not recover under their policy for damage resulting to the death of a third person, and that's what we have in this case, the death of a third person. Now, the second issue, as I see it in this case, is that the...
Well, down on the federal case you're citing, did they have a similar statute to what South Dakota has?
That was construed a Mississippi statute, and I think that statute is very similar, as I recall reading it.
All right.
What about the wrongful death portion of it? Do they have a similar wrongful death statute?
Your Honor, I can't recall without reading that, but I'm going to address the wrongful death statute in my third point.
Before you go there, though, tell me about Ms. Turbeck's argument that this interpretation would effectively preclude any claim for death of an insured by Scott Boyd.
I think not, because the statute refers to death. If you specifically refers to death.
Well, how would Mr. Glow himself recover for wrongful death under your interpretation?
I believe you've got to take in consideration the effect of a wrongful death statute, which I'm going to address later, which is an exclusive remedy. And I believe that the personal representative would qualify as an insured to bring those actions. Did I answer your question?
Well, I still don't understand how Mr. Glow could recover wrongful death damages in this case if he were the one that was injured.
I don't think he can recover in his individual capacity, and I'm going to address that later on.
And why would the legislature use the word death in the underinsured statute?
Well, I guess I can't read their mind, and I think, though, it's really immaterial as if you consider the exceptions that I pointed out. Anyway, going to the second point, I believe the majority of the courts have held in these situations that there is no recovery for these kind of actions. And this court has kind of alluded to that in, I think, several cases, including Clark versus Regent Insurance Company. And in Clark, this court cited at footnote 5, the Illinois case of Barnes versus Powell. Thereafter, in the 1989, Judge Batty, in a federal case, considered the Barnes case and stated that the intent of the legislature was that the uninsured motorist coverage would protect an insured generally against injuries caused by motorists who were uninsured. Again, this court and Judge Batty are referring to injuries to the insured. Now, in the Valiant case, the 1990 Florida case, that case very aptly analyzed these issues and, among other things, cited the authorities that sustained the position of Ivy Mutual in this case.
What do you say about your opponent's position that the court that made that decision has countered it or set up a red flag?
I don't think that's true myself from reading the cases, because they cite as authorities from Alaska, California, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arizona, and also cite Wittes and Couch. And again, when I come back to the Delancey case, which was the federal case, wherein the federal court stated, we conclude that neither Mississippi's uninsured motorist statute nor its wrongful death statute mandates that policyholders be able to recover under their underinsured motorist policies for their damages resulting from the death of a third person.
What? How do you explain the language in SDCL 58-11-9 where they define the person that is legally entitled to recover damages. What, how do you explain that language under your theory? What does that mean, then, in the statute?
In what statute is that, Your Honor?
It's, well, it's the it's 5811-9, I think the one you referred to earlier, and it it basically says, for protection of persons insured thereunder who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators.
Well, I...
For the bodily injury or death. And then it says, it goes on with the legally entitled to recover damages. How do you explain that wording in our statute?
Well,
what does
I'm
that
going
mean?
To get to, I think, to that, my third point, and that is that under our wrongful death statute, which is an exclusive remedy for death benefits, the only one that can bring the action is the personal representative, and therefore, Mr. Glow, in the individual capacity, does not have any right for death benefits. But going back to the other jurisdictions, the trial court cited the Colorado case, and that case sums this matter up very clearly when it says, reading the uninsured motorist provision as broadly as plaintiffs suggest would, contrary to common sense, allow a recovery of uninsured motorist benefits for the death of an individual who was not insured, who did not reside in a claimant's household, and who, had he survived, would not have had any right recovery under the policy. That's the situation we have here. I think that's a very good decision. I think the trial court was correct, and it should be affirmed. The third issue, which I think is really probably the most important issue in this matter, is that Mr. Glow is not the real party in interest, and he does not have an individual claim for damages as a result of the wrongful death of his parents. Ms. Turbeck, in her opening statement this morning, claims that his claim is the sole claim that's before the court. I respectfully state, Your Honors, that he does not have any individual claim. Our wrongful death benefits are mandated by SDC 2155, which provides every action for the wrongful death shall be for the exclusive benefit of the wife, husband, or children, and it shall be brought in the name of the executor or regular special administrator of the deceased person. Now, this court has repeatedly held, starting in 1913 in the case of Roe versus Richards, that an individual cannot bring an individual action for wrongful death benefits.
But he still is the real party in interest if the statute says it's brought for the benefit of the children, isn't he?
He may have a beneficiary interest, but he cannot bring the action because it says shall be brought in the name of the executor, special administrator, of the deceased person.
Well, why didn't you bring in then the representative of the estate as a third party defendant? I mean, that's easily taken care of, isn't it, as far as this action?
I don't know if I follow you on that, Your Honor, because...
Well, the representative isn't going to pocket 2 cents whether this case is won or lost. It's going to be Scott Glow, so doesn't that make him the real party in interest?
No. He can't go contrary to statute. Now, this court also said in Hoekstra versus Helgeland that when an action is brought under our wrongful death statutes, it is an exclusive remedy. So we have an issue, exclusive remedy, and the real party in interest. If the wrongful death statutes create an exclusive remedy, then no one else can bring any action. No one else has any claim for wrongful death unless you follow the statute.
Now, what happens to the money if he wins? Doesn't it go to Scott Glow and his siblings?
No, he's going to put it in his own pocket. It's
personal representative can.
Yeah, the personal representative distributes it to the beneficiary, but in this particular case, Mr. Glow wants the money himself. That's what the pleading set up and alleged.
Well, he is one of the children the statute refers to, isn't he?
Yes, but he wants to take all the recovery and not divide it with the rest of the siblings.
Isn't that between him and them?
But if he has rights under his insurance policy in accord with the statutes of South Dakota, that exclusive remedy deal, that provides an exclusive remedy as to the personal representative. But if he has rights under his insurance policy that are over and above those exclusive remedies, then certainly he can recover under his own insurance policy that he bought and paid for, can't he?
Your Honor, as I read the authorities say this is an exclusive remedy. It sounds in tort, and therefore the claim is under the wrongful death statutes. He does not have an individual claim for wrongful death benefits under the policy.
But does it exclude contractual obligations of his own insurance company?
Yes. Because
if there's an outside contract, that just gets that becomes void and of no effect because of an exclusive remedy language?
That's my opinion. And I think Judge Porter in Bethel versus Janus came to the same conclusion. Judge Porter stated, "It is fundamental that in the absence of a statute providing for recovery, no cause of action for wrongful death lies. An action brought under the wrongful death statute is an exclusive remedy, and the legislature is free to place restrictions upon it." Now, that's what Judge Porter said. This court has basically said the same thing. In fact, this court in Ulvig versus McKinnon Hospital, which is cited by Ms. Turbeck in her reply brief, comes to the same conclusion. Now, I know that Ms. Turbeck and Mr. Glow are relying upon Sanders versus Gieb, and I want to address that for a minute. There's only one short paragraph in that case that is material to these issues. And in that case, then Chief Justice Miller stated, "Under the facts of this case, Kim's surviving husband and her surviving children could have each brought a separate wrongful death action at a different time." I submit to your honors that that's dictum. Further, it is directly contrary to the statute, and it's contrary to the prior decisions of this court. And as I mentioned, in 1930, in the Ulvig case, this court stated that these wrongful death statutes provide for a new remedy to be enforced by the personal representative. If it's to be enforced by the personal representative, then I do not believe that anyone else can bring an action for wrongful death benefits except the personal representative or special administrator or one of those people authorized by statute. Now, in the Kentucky case of Wheeler versus Hartford Accident Insurance Company, the court considered this case, I mean this issue, and ruled that the personal representative, while she may have ultimately have a claim to her insurance company, did not justify her in proceeding in an individual capacity and dismissed her action.
You don't recognize that the statutes or the law provide a distinction between an exclusive remedy, which is a legal remedy, as opposed to contractual rights under an insurance policy that are bought and paid for?
Well, I don't believe this claim sounds in contract. It's based upon a tort, and therefore the wrongful death statute has precedent.
It's a claim under the language of the insurance policy with a side attempt to eliminate the language that she claims is prohibited by the statute.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is that I believe in the Wheeler case, the Kentucky court took the opposite view, and that's the view I'm espousing here.
Okay, thank you.
But Mr. Matthews, to follow up, this is a contractual claim. This claim is a claim under an insurance contract.
Well, I'll say the same thing I said to Justice Sabers, Your Honor. I believe that wrongful death benefits, period, must be brought in accordance with the wrongful death statutes. No exceptions. There's no other claim for wrongful death in the state of South Dakota except if you follow the wrongful death statutes. And I believe it sounds in tort and not in contract.
Or even with the wrongful death claim, each of the individuals that were our next of kin, whether it's the son in this case or if there were more, each of them has to prove their own damages, do they not?
No.
Those two?
The personal representative proves the damages that they all sustain. I'm running out of time here, but my last point is that the release precludes them from bringing this action. And again, I come back to exclusive remedy. If the statute is exclusive remedy, the personal representative gives a release, then how can they bring a separate action when the tortfeasor has been released? And I think this court in the case of Peterson versus Remfer, which I didn't cite in my briefs, but it was an 18 Northwest 2nd in 1945, addressed this issue and said a release extinguishes the obligation of the tortfeasor and bars action by their personal representative. If that's true in that case, I think it's also true in this case.
Well, did the personal representative specifically release Iowa Mutual?
No, they released the tortfeasor.
And you're saying that covers on everybody else, whether they had a contractual or a tort obligation?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it releases any claim for wrongful death benefits under the statute, and therefore everyone else falls within that release.
No matter what a contract would say.
Well, I will come back to that, but again, I want to say that if we have an exclusive remedy, if the wrongful death statute is exclusive, it's got to be exclusive for everything.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Your time has expired. Ms. Turbeck, you have 10 minutes.
Ms. Turbeck, I have a question before you start.
Sure.
Okay, you brought this case for wrongful death damages, correct?
No, I brought this case as a declaratory action to establish insurance coverage.
For wrongful death damages,
yes.
Okay. So why was there a tactical reason why you chose to bring this in Scott Glow's name as an individual instead of as a personal representative? Because our statutes do require that wrongful death claims be pursued by the personal representative.
If this were a claim for wrongful death damages, it would have had to have been brought in the name of a personal representative. It is a declaratory judgment action to ask the court to declare whether there's coverage or not. This is not an action for damages. This is an action for coverage.
So you're saying this is a contractual dispute and you disagree with Mr. Matthews?
Yes, sir. And in fact, I'd go a step further and say, in fact, it'd be, talk about tactics. I think you could engage in shameless tactics if we really were going to follow up on the proposal that we key in on the personal representative. I suppose I'd find the personal representative that had the largest UIM policy and then bring the claim under his policy if that's really where it went. But obviously the law is looking at who's ultimately entitled to damages, not in whose name it's brought.
So Mr. Glow is not entitled to pursue this claim, is he?
Absolutely.
As an individual?
Are you saying to pursue the tort claim for damages or the contract claim for coverage?
Both. I mean, he's seeking wrongful death benefits. Damages, I should say.
Yes.
That has to be brought in the name of, generally would be brought in the name of the PR.
True, but as we know, for example, from Helmholtz versus Lamars, you don't have to proceed with the actual tort action and reduce it to judgment before you can make your UIM claim. And indeed, virtually almost never is that really done. I mean, we'd have almost no settlements if that's the way it really went.
Well, he couldn't go the other way either. I mean, he's bringing it on behalf of an estate. Wouldn't the estate have to have some insurance?
Well, of course.
He couldn't have brought it as a personal representative.
Well, no, actually, you know, I think part of what confuses folks in this is that wrongful death claims are brought in the name of the personal representative of the decedent as a matter of statutory procedure. They are not brought on behalf of the estate. We tend to sometimes get sloppy, I think, in our talking, but
I mean,
it really isn't the estate.
The decedent didn't have insurance, but I mean, the decedent wouldn't be covered either on this. So
the decedent wouldn't on this, but obviously one could nominate just about anyone you wanted as a personal representative of the decedent. So if that person's identity and their coverage were key, the recovery could go anywhere. But I don't think that's what the law really anticipates. I think it's looking at who's ultimately entitled to the damages. And whether it's a tort claim for injury or whether it's a tort claim for wrongful death, certainly when there's a dispute that comes up over underinsured or uninsured motorist, the ordinary procedure is to bring, for the insured, the named insured, to bring a declaratory judgment seeking that the court resolve the issue of coverage, as because it's a contract claim. In fact, this whole claim really comes down to a principle that's almost elementary, and the principle is this: whoever has the claim has to be an insured. I mean, who's got the claim here? If we're talking about the claim of the decedents, then of course they would have to be insured. But in this case, we're talking about Scott Glow's claim, and so he has to be the insured. And it's undisputed that he is. This is consistent with the system that the legislature set up. Going back, if we think about how it first got set up with the liability mandatory coverage initially, obviously the legislature has announced a public policy that says we want everybody to have liability insurance, so that when you are legally entitled to damages from another driver, they can compensate you. Then the next step in that dual system is that if you have incurred damages, you are legally entitled to damages, but that person has inadequate liability coverage, then you can collect from your own first party coverage. And I remind the court, this is mandatory coverage. The legislature has said this, that you have to provide this coverage, and you have to provide it in at least an equal amount to whatever liability coverage you're selling. And before, when I mentioned the 100,000 figures in the statute, it says that that's the most that's statutorily required unless the insured requests more. And in this case, he requested and purchased $250,000 per person of UIM coverage. So what we're dealing here with is a person who has, under our underinsured system, he's got uncompensated damages for a claim he's legally entitled to collect. He purchased underinsured motorist coverage, arguably ample underinsured motorist coverage, to compensate him for those damages, and the insurer is now trying not to pay the damages because they've interjected an artificial requirement that's irrelevant to the claim and contrary to the policy of the state as announced by the legislature and contrary to the language. Now, referring to the Delancey case out of Mississippi, that was the federal case out of Mississippi, tells us nothing, because incidentally, it's not true that Mississippi's wrongful death statute is the same. And I, as detailed in the brief, our brief at page 11, the rebuttal brief, wrongful death claims in Mississippi are entirely derivative of the decedent's claim. They're part of the decedent's own claim for personal injuries before death. The decedent's estate may be entitled to recover damages, and all claims have to be presented in a single lawsuit. So the situation in Mississippi is different. Somebody else has the claim in Mississippi. That's why somebody else has to be insured in Mississippi. Similarly, in Florida, they have a very different wrongful death statute. It's explained and cited at page 13 of our reply brief. In Florida, a wrongful death claim is not for the exclusive benefit of statutory beneficiaries. Rather, the claim includes the decedent's surviving claim for injuries before death, and the decedent's estate itself may recover damages, and is subject to creditors of the estate. So again, in Florida, we're talking about somebody else that has the claim. And so naturally, the Florida court may well have said, well, then that entity or person has to be insured. It's interesting that the insurer brings up the case of Kentucky and cites it, because in fact, in Kentucky, it's true they said, well, look, you have to bring a wrongful death action, you have to be appointed personal representative of the decedent. But what that case also says about coverage, and it's just a sentence or two, but it's cited in our brief, the court says the mother, the insured, her coverage was never at issue. The only issue was procedurally whether she could bring the claim or not. Subject to the terms and conditions, that's where these folks are trying to avoid the statute here by saying, well, we've inserted this term and condition and we want you to enforce it no matter what the statute says and no matter how absurd the results. But if we go back to the language of the statute, and really that's the primary place to get the intent of the legislature, it's obvious that they are talking about insureds entitled to collect damages for death. It says, and I quote, the insurance company agrees to pay its own insured for uncompensated damages as its insured may recover on account of bodily injury or death. Our legislature did not say to pay its own insured's next of kin. It did not say for damages its insured may recover, its insured's next of kin may recover. And when it said on account of injury or death, it didn't say just on account of injury. And it didn't say on account of bodily injury or death of its insured. The legislature had ample opportunity, if they wanted to adopt the rules that the insurer is promoting, to make our statute read that way. And when they talked about the amount of coverage, the legislature repeatedly said that the coverage, when it talked about the limits, it repeatedly referred to bodily injury or death of one person or two or more persons, even though in the very next clause it used the word insured. So clearly our legislative language, the statutory language, says we're supposed to deal with claims that the insured has for the death of a person, not for his own death. But this proposal that Iowa Mutual makes not only violates the language of the statute, it has to be rejected because to enforce it would create absurd results. We have to bear in mind the purpose of underinsured motorists is to compensate insureds with uncompensated damages caused by an underinsured motorist. And we realize how absurd the results would be if we compare two UIM claimants, one with a bodily injury, no matter how slight, but a claim for his own bodily injury, and that's going to be fully compensated, but the other UIM claimant who has a horrendous damage claim, perhaps from the death of a child, or the death of a parent, or the death of a spouse, or from medical expenses incurred on behalf of a child. And yet under all those scenarios, the right to exclude coverage because it wasn't the insured himself who sustained physical bodily injury would result in an absurd anomaly. Similarly, when we have liability carriers providing coverage for wrongful death claims, no matter whether the claimant was injured or not, it makes no sense to have the UIM insurer who stands in their shoes be able to escape responsibility for those same damages. I urge you to reverse the trial court and announce that the provision in this case cannot be enforced.
Thank you, Mr. Vick. We had a scheduling conflict on what would have been the 10 o'clock case. That has been placed on the October calendar, so the court will be in recess until 11 o'clock today, at which time it will hold its next oral argument in the interest of LN. We'll be in recess till 11 o'clock.